Thanks for tuning in to the Animal Control Report podcast, where we help debunk the dog catcher stereotype. A lot of times people think it's a dog catcher when they hear about animal control officers. But here on the Animal Control Report, we change that by taking you inside the day-to-day operations of animal control officers. Not only will you hear stories of animal control officers, but you'll hear from industry experts as well. We are also part of the Keep It Humane podcast network. We have some amazing partners there, so check them out at keepithumane.com/podcast network. You can listen to all the animal control and animal welfare related podcast there. And let's continue to help people help animals.
Welcome to the Animal Control Report with your hosts,
Ashley Bishop.
Wait, what? Yes, folks, that is Ashley Bishop. If you missed our last episode, then you missed our introduction with Ashley Bishop from Texas. She's filling in for Ashley Bishop, if that doesn't get anyone confused.
It's all right. We're going to call me Texas Bishop from here on. Let's do that.
Texas Bishop. Yeah. So just for our listeners, remember to check out our website, keepithumane.com. Check out our podcast network, keepithumane.com/podcast network. Also, check out livetrap.com for awesome stuff. Tomahawk Live Trap. They have some great things going on. I've really been talking about their bite sticks recently. Normal Bishop. I don't know how I say this. OG Bishop. Was talking about how she bought Rescue there recently, and yeah. You can use discount code Keep It Humane for 10% off your order at livetrap.com. So check that out. Check out our socials, the Animal Control Report on Facebook, also on Instagram, and that TikTok. We have some stuff, but I don't do a lot with it because I'm tired and I'm old. So I need young people to help with that.
On another note with Livetrap, they were awesome during the COVID pandemic. That's where we were getting all of our rescue because it was so hard to get anywhere else.
Oh, that's so good to know.
Shouts out to them. It was awesome.
That is awesome. That's good stuff. How are things in Texas, Bishop?
They're good. The weather's been a little funky still. It keeps getting cold and rainy and then hot and cold, rainy, hot. So, you know, we've been very busy. My agency has been incredibly busy. Lots of bite cases coming in. So, you know, we've been staying busy.
Understood. It's that time of the year. You know, we start getting those bat calls. We start getting just all the elements of like life is starting to kind of come back into full swing. So it gets a little crazy for us out there in the field. So cool. Well, we have a fun one today. I'm really excited to talk about this case. We're gonna do a little bit of a case study with this about this dog named Jake, and we have a forensic veterinarian, Dr. Wolf, on with us today, and so she's going to help break some of that down. Dr. Wolf, why don't you introduce yourself and just let our listeners know a little bit about you, how you got into this profession, and what you do now.
Sure. Hi, I'm Jennifer Wolf. I'm a veterinarian, graduated a long time ago from the University of Florida.
And did you work with Dr. Yeah. Jason Bird down there?
I have worked with Dr. Bird. He is in charge of the entomology graduate program veterinary forensics. Yes, he is a forensic entomologist. And he and I have worked together a couple of times because I used to teach in the program for the University of Florida's veterinary forensics program after I finished getting my own master's degree there.
Sorry to sidetrack us. He's just I love that guy. He's so interesting and always has some great stories. So shout out Dr. Bird.
Yes. He is very interesting and he has a lot of human and animal experience, which kind of threw me the first time I saw one of his lectures at a veterinary conference and he put up humans. And we're all going, wait a minute, we do vet stuff. We don't do human stuff. What is this? But at this point, I do a couple of different jobs. I work for Veterinary Information Network, doing a couple of different things for them, but part of it is as a topic specialist in veterinary forensics. So I answer questions on the message boards from other veterinarians about cases where they're concerned about animal abuse. And I also put together reference material, journal articles, this kind of stuff, so that the veterinary community who are all members of VIN can access materials to help out with their own cases and their own research. And then my moonlighting job is my own business, Wolf Veterinary Forensics Consulting, where I do education, consultation, and sometimes investigation of animal abuse cases, and also do some relief work for local shelters.
That's amazing. Dr. Wolf, what kind of got you into the forensic aspect of veterinary medicine?
I fell into it.
Okay.
I was working at an animal shelter, had finished doing spay neuters that morning, was going to take a lunch break, and my executive director said, "Hey, can you come with us into the field? We need to do a triage. We think we're taking in about 25 to 50 fighting dogs." And I said, "Okay, I can go with you and I can certainly do triage. I know nothing about the criminal aspects, the legal aspects. They didn't teach us any of that in veterinary school." And she said, "No problem. I'll tell you everything you need to know in the car on the drive over." Needless to say, I didn't learn everything I needed to know in the car. So we got to the scene. It was the most eye-opening thing I had been through at that point in veterinary medicine, as far as I was concerned. It was a dogfighting rink in the middle of a large metropolitan city. It involved 33 dogs total. They were located in a garage off of the guy's house. They were in crates stacked three on top of each other. No food, no water, just the crates. The dog didn't have enough room to lie down.
Wow.
So we took in 33 dogs that day, and I ended up later on having to testify in that case. So it was kind of a crime scene to courtroom, baptism by fire. So that's what got me interested in forensics, because I didn't know anything about it and I knew I needed to learn a lot more.
So that kind of motivated you to say, wait a second, I have the opportunity to educate myself more on this type of stuff, and I'm going to do that.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I started just reading anything I could find. I think it was about 2 years later that the University of Florida started their forensics program. So I was amongst the first 40 some odd students in the program, went through to get my graduate certificate first, and then stayed on to get my master's degree and stayed on to continue teaching.
Can we back up a little bit to the Veterinary
Sure.
Information Board? Is that what you called it?
Veterinary Information Network.
Network. Okay. And so is this open to like all veterinarians throughout the country? What does that look like?
It is a website, online, international membership. We are available to any veterinarian who would like to get membership. They can sign up for it. And then there's also some access available to staff members of veterinary hospitals. Different levels of access depending on what it is that the person does. The part for the veterinarians is mostly message boards where veterinarians can post cases to get advice from colleagues, whether they are general practice colleagues, or we have a lot of specialists who work with us and do consultations. So cardiologists, surgeons, ophthalmologists, dermatologists, and so on. We do small animal, large animal, and exotics. And as I mentioned, we are international. So we represent, I don't know exactly how many countries at this point, but I think we have over 100,000 membership. So
I'm on the website now.
me too. Me
It's
too.
really
This
cool.
is yeah, this is neat.
Vin.com. It's not to check your car's car history. VIN.com. And
Correct.
it is there's I'm going to tell all my veterinary friends. Some of them probably do know about it, but some of them may not. And this looks really cool. And I know for us, you know, dealing with the different unique things that we see in the field as animal control or what comes into the shelter, it's really good to have resources, right? And so this is I might have to dig a little deeper into this page because I think that that's really beneficial to the community. And I don't know how where you stand on it, just kind of your perception. I know there's kind of Actually, I'll just ask the question straight up. Do you think there's a shortage of veterinarians in this country?
I think it ebbs and flows. But if you'd asked in 2008 whether or not we had a shortage, we would have said we have a surplus. Veterinarians were like everybody else during the economic downfall at that time. And it was the first time I'd ever heard of veterinarians being laid off because there wasn't enough business. And then come along to COVID, and everybody runs out and gets himself a COVID pet. And because of many factors going on at veterinary clinics, the same problems everybody else was having with a lack of staff. Staff having to be off because of their own illnesses or caregiving duties. There's a lot of women in the veterinary field, and usually it is women who take off when the kids need something, and kids are home from school a lot. There was a decrease in efficiency at veterinary clinics because they were having to do curbside work for the most part, that the animals would be picked up at the car, brought into the clinic, done whatever needs to be done, taken back out. All still having to do a lot of gloving and personal protective equipment type changes, and then communicating with an owner via a phone call or FaceTime or whatever, so as to be able to talk with them about the case. It really messed up the efficiency for a lot of veterinary clinics. And so a lot of veterinarians were quite overworked and burning out at that time. Fast forward a few more years to where we are now. Economy has been down a little bit. People have been losing jobs or losing some of their income. They've had to move to new places where they're not allowed to take pets because the rental doesn't allow for that. Many other factors come into play, and the shelters are overwhelmed, and the veterinary clinics are seeing a sliding down of the number of clients that they're seeing, the amount of business that they're seeing right now. The shelters are overwhelmed with too many kittens and puppies because spay neuter wasn't happening at the same level during COVID. Animal abuse cases, of course, continue to bring things in, stray animals, lack of microchips and tags, so animals can't get returned as easily. Shelters are quite busy right now. They
And not to
definitely
put
are.
words in your mouth, but that's a long way to say yes.
That is a long way to say yes, but I feel
it,
like it's all important to know.
well, and all those factors are super important, and that's why we stress on the show, and that's why I stress professionally and personally, like access to care and being able to spay and neuter pets is extremely important. Extremely, extremely important.
Yes.
And yeah, so we won't go down that rabbit hole because Bishop will be here for 17 hours, and I know we all got things to do today.
That's all right.
Do y'all want to jump into this case study about Jake?
For sure. It was very interesting.
It gets really interesting. And so I'm going to share my screen and we're going to look at a couple little things here. And let's see here.
I will
But
say this is one of the best reports I have ever seen.
this dog, Jake, excuse me, was brought in. Well, he was actually adopted from the shelter on, it was May, let's see, May 15th, I believe, of 2020.
Wow.
So he was, I'm sorry. Yeah, May 15th. He was a Australian Shepherd type dog, red merle and white. He was about just under 2 years. He was 1 year, 10 months ish is what we aged him at. And he was adopted by a dude named Ben Hatfield. Ben Hatfield lived in the city and county of Denver. Younger guy, probably, I can find out his exact age, but probably at the time of adoption in his mid-20s, mid, maybe upper 20s. And the adoption contract, there was no red flags. There was nothing that jumped out to our adoption council team. They adopted a dog. The one thing that was really interesting, though, was that they really, the front desk, the adoption team really had and I don't want to use the word attachment, but had a connection with Jake. They really liked this dog. They often would bring him up front and he would hang out in the back area. Like there's a Like you'd have the front desk and then there's like a vestibule, I guess you would call it. And he would sometimes hang out there. So like they knew him. And he was just an overall good dog. So what ended up happening, if you fast forward to September 11th of 2020, the dog was brought back in a black trash bag by the actual adopter. So there was, excuse me, there was a little bit of concern there because they were like, wait a second, why is this dog that we just adopted out 4 months ago back and deceased? It was a healthy dog. There were no issues that we knew about it. And we were really concerned that like something bad happened. What's the sad part is there wasn't a protocol in place to look at deceased animals when they came into the animal shelter. So I'm not sure how many of these type of cases we missed. It just so happened that Jake, because he was a familiar dog to us, is why we decided to open the bag and take a look. And so what happened at that point is one of the front desk attendants said, well, this is weird. Like, this was Jake. Let's see what's going on. So she opens the bag. Let me see if I can put this in the chat for you to see, actually. And sure enough, the first thing that they notice is Jake's muzzle is like wrapped shut, muzzle wrapped so tight. I mean, and when I say so tight, these videos that you'll see on the video on YouTube or on Spotify, it's alarming. And you can see this one in the chat. I just threw it in there. And so that's how the dog was presented. He was presented muzzle wrapped and obviously deceased in the plastic bag. So they get Officer Humphreys. Officer Humphreys did such an amazing job on this case. And she, for whatever reason, man, she gets the worst cases. I don't know, Bishop, I don't know if you have officers like that down there in Texas, that they tend to get the worst cases ever.
Yes, all the time. We actually are just dealing with something on Friday, and it's like always one particular officer. Always.
Always. And Humphreys, she rocks it. She rocks it out. I know that she's like, she's an all-star when it comes to that stuff. And like, unfortunately, she was the first one to have to deal with this case. And so they take him out of the bag. They're examining him. They see some maybe like abrasions and some other things to the body under his arm. I'm going to put this in the chat because I want Dr. Wolf to see this too. Under his arm, there's a pretty significant abrasion, which made me think that, okay, how, like, was there something like tied to him? And there's a blue, and I don't know if you use these, Bishop, in your shelter, but those blue nylon braided leashes,
Yep.
very common in animal shelters. There's one on him as well around his neck, but it's not all there. Like it seems like it was either cut or chewed or something of that nature, right? So there looked to have been a struggle as well. And so Humphreys grabs me, and unbeknownst to me, and this is my fault. So I just want to apologize publicly. I really do, because when I get cases like these, or when I used to work the field, like I think my adrenaline just gets going and I just don't stop. Like I'm just like, let's get this motherfucker. Like there's no stop until we do.
I'm the same. I'm the same. I'm the exact same.
But what I screwed up with is Jenna, Officer Humphreys, was like, dude, I would like for you to guide me. Like she wanted to do the whole thing. And I screwed up and I just took over. So it's a really cool story of how we like tracked him down and all that stuff. And so we go to his property, which is in the city and county of Denver, and he's not there. There's no answer. And we're like, well, we don't want to tip him off or anything and try calling the phone numbers we have. So I don't know, Bishop, do you ever use True People Search?
Yes.
Yeah. So True People Search is like a free website that you can just put in a name and I think it's got about a 60% accuracy rate somewhere in there. So we did that and we got a alternative address for this dude because his name's not like super common. So we get this alternative address and We're like, we're just going to go. So we show up, she and I show up, knock on a door, and it was like his aunt. It was his grandmother's house, but his aunt was there, and he was there too. And he, when I describe him, so first we asked the aunt if he was there, and she's like, yeah, what's going on? And then we talked to the grandma, and so we get him, he's there. Officer Humphreys talks to the grandma and the aunt separately, and I talk to him separately. And just to give you context, like his body language and his demeanor, he was so monotone and so like completely like, I'm trying to portray him here on the video. When he talked, he would just be like, well, the dog woke me up in the middle of the night. Like he had no emotion, zero, like zero, zero emotion. He was kind of scary in that way that he just didn't see what his actions were. So as I start to interview him, one of the first things I see on his hands are bite marks, right? Which are pretty apparent that some sort of altercation happened between him and the dog. And Bishop, I don't know about you, but when you get these cases and people just start to tell you everything, you're just like, this is golden. Like, tell me more.
Yeah, and you just kind of let them talk. And, I have to say, my assistant supervisor is so good at this because she's been doing this forever, 17 years working with PD. I mean, she is so good at it. So good at it.
And so he just starts telling me the whole story. Now, this is probably 36 hours from the incident, 24 to 30. This is probably 36 hours. And I wish I had an audio recording to this case. I thought I did, but must have been left on my work phone or work documents or whatever, and I just don't have it. But as I start to ask him questions, Ben starts to say, well, and I just ask him general questions. How have things been going with Jake? Like, you've only had him for a few months. And he would talk about like Jake was pretty hyper and he would try to exercise him. Now, granted, you have to go back to the type of dog this is, right? This is a working breed that has a lot of energy. So exercise, enrichment, all those are necessary factors to try to maintain quality of life, in my opinion, for a breed like that. If you live in a small apartment, which he did, and don't do much with the dog's going to get bored and maybe destructive.
Correct.
So he starts telling the story of that night of the incident. And he claims that it was around midnight and he woke up to poop on the bed, that Jake defecated on the bed, which I don't know, man. For a bigger dog, like a larger dog, that just seems odd. Doc, I want to bring you in from behavioral aspects. Do dogs, like, do you know of dogs that poop on the bed?
Yes, but I'm t right now thinking of animal hoarding cases. So yeah, they
Absolutely.
certainly can, particularly if they're having like diarrhea or something where it's an accident and not intentional. But I agree with a larger dog that if it were to defecate in the house, I would expect it on the floor.
And that's what really threw me off. And I, as I discussed this case and as I looked at facts, I was like, was there a bestiality, a sexual component to this that we missed? And I don't know. And I don't think anything was saw on the necropsy that indicated that. But that just makes me think, like, what was going on that there would be potential defecation on the bed, et cetera. Because he was just weird like that. He just gave you that vibe that like anything was possible in the world of animal cruelty with this dude. So he says that the dog defecated on the bed. He then shoved the dog's nose in it because that's what everybody that's uneducated about behavior with dogs that does. And the dog defended itself, and then that's where he got the bites on his hands. After he got bit on his hands, he claimed that he punched the dog several times, got angry, wrapped the muzzle as you saw in those photos, and he then tied the dog to a bicycle in the living room. He said this all happened within a few minutes of that midnight time. And then when he woke up the next morning around 6 a.m., the dog was deceased. He then didn't know what to do, put the dog in a trash bag. Maybe he just had a, I don't know if you can use moral compass, or maybe he knew the dog was microchipped, but he threw the dog actually in one of the communal dumpsters right behind his apartment first. And then he was like, eh, I don't want to do that. So then he calls grandma and says, hey, I would really like to take this dog to get cremated and get the ashes back. So he brings it to the shelter, the Denver shelter, and that's when we find out about the case. So he did request the ashes. I asked my supervisor if I could just put charcoal ashes in a box and give them back to him, but he said no. I mean, he wouldn't know the difference of like, just he can use old grill ashes.
I mean, the reality is, do any of us really open up those urns or anything? I know I don't, and I have plenty of them.
I did work at a shelter that we had an incinerator, and I got to watch firsthand like how you actually have to grind the ashes after they're incinerated. It's pretty crazy. Anyway, I digress. So then he brings the dog to the shelter, and that's what happens. So, I mean, he basically tells us the whole story of dog poops on bed, he punches dog in the face, or it strikes it multiple times, not just in the face. Dog then defends itself. He gets mad because the dog bites him. He then wraps the muzzle and then ties the dog up to a bike. And all. He had ne like literally, Dr. Wolf and Bishop, he had zero emotion as he told the story. He basically was just like, yeah, I mean, that's what I did. And I don't really feel bad about it. And so we had to then corroborate. Is that the word? Corroborate. I don't do well with words. Corroborate his story by sending it up to Colorado State University, who does most of our, or when I was there, most of our necropsies. Cool thing about Colorado State, or not Colorado State, necropsies in general, and we've talked about this on the show a few different times, is the ASPCA having that necropsy lab in Florida, kind of close to the University of Florida, and they offer necropsies at a free. Basically, all you have to do is find a box and find ice packs, and they'll pay for everything else. They'll pay for the shipping, and then they do all the stuff. And so, but we used CSU for this one, and they did an amazing job. And just wanted to bring Dr. Wolf in, and we can talk about the necropsy.
Now, Dan, when he dropped off the dog, did he say anything or did any of the staff notice the dog bites on his hand or anything?
No, but on the form, I'm glad you mentioned that. So on the relinquishment form, there is a part where you actually put, did the dog bite in the past 10 days? And he did. He said yes. The dude did not lie. He did not lie. He said yes.
Interesting.
Wondering why he wanted the ashes back, given that he doesn't seem to have an emotional attachment to the dog.
Isn't that wild, right? When we understand the psyche of animal cruelty and the sociopath behavior, because that dude is a, in my opinion, a clear sociopath. Like, just based on what I saw. And now, can I obviously I can't like diagnose him, but just based on the energy and the way that he responded to certain things, may serial killers collect things from all their victims, so maybe this is victim one. I don't know. He was born in 93, by the way, if you want to age him. So that makes him right around 30, 31. So
Correct.
at the time, 2020, he was in his late 20s.
Interesting. I find it interesting that you're describing his personality. I feel like a lot of the cases that we dealt with in my area of the state, most, I want to say 80% of the people are kind of the same way. Very monotone about the whole situation, just no emotion whatsoever. Rarely do we ever find a case where we find somebody who is very emotional about what happened after they tell us the truth or we find out the truth and we connect the dots. Do I find them very emotional about everything that happened?
Yeah, it's true. All right, Dr. Wolf, I'm going to bring you in. And for our listeners, the necropsy report, I'm going to actually pull that up so I can take a look at it while we're basically on the same page. No pun intended. Me and my bad jokes. So the necropsy was performed at CSU, and that was done on the final report. This is the final, I believe, was done. So it was received on the 11th of September. Oh, actually, let me back up. Let me back up before we even get into that. So he was fully admitted everything. He fully like told us the whole story, but wouldn't let us in his apartment. He's like, nah, bro, you can't come in. Now, granted, he wasn't there at the time. He was at his grandma's house with his aunt. But he was like, nah, I'm not letting y'all in. And I was like, well, that's dumb. Now, Bishop, from do you, like, and for the case purposes, do we need to go into the apartment?
For us, it's iffy. I would say yes, so you can find where the animal was actually at. But for us here, sometimes it's a matter of whether or not we want to push to go beyond reasonable doubt at that point in time. If we already have enough on our end. So yes.
I mean, I think we had enough. I do. I really do. I will say that this is what happens is I go overboard. I'm like, I need to do more. And the reason being is the jury, if necessary, needs to see the crime scene, right? And in order to do that, we needed to get a search warrant. And who knows what else? There could have been seven other animals tied up in his house. You don't know, right? You
True.
just don't know, especially with a weirdo like that. And so he wouldn't allow us in the apartment, which is just, it seems so weird. He told us everything, but then he was like, nah, you can't go into my space. So obviously we had enough for a search warrant at that time. And we got to work with the local police department because of it being a potential felony. We didn't charge felonies, that all went through the police department. And we actually, I don't even think they can charge misdemeanors. That probably goes through the police department as well. They can only charge city violations, and this was more than a city violation, though there is an animal cruelty component on a city ticket. It's just this level rises to the level of felony. So we work with a detective, and this all happens within like a 3 hour span. Go interview him, like go collect all of our evidence. I wrote up a supplemental report, sent that to a detective. They tweak it a little bit, and then they get the search warrant in that case. So we go in. The apartment was actually pretty organized and clean for the most part. Walk around the apartment, see the bicycle where he tied the dog to. It's hung on the wall, and then go into the bedroom. There is no smell of feces, there is no stain of feces, there is no evidence of feces whatsoever. The weird thing that stood out to me is the bathtub was, or the bath was kind of wet, but the dog didn't seem wet when we got it, but the bathtub was wet. Now, Denver is a high desert, and it's just there's like 4% humidity there, so it's just super duper dry all the time. So if he did bathe the dog, it is plausible that the dog dried within that 36-hour time frame. But it's that's just that component of the bath being wet and there being like dog fur in the drain just didn't sit right with me, but I didn't have anything else to go off of. So then we went in the apartment, documented it, took photos, took a couple samples of things. There was a little bit of blood on the floor right by the bicycle. Not a lot of blood, but yeah, it was there. So we collected all that stuff and then sent it up for a necropsy. It was delivered the same day, so they got it on the 11th, it looks like, and then we got the final report 2 weeks later.
Was there anything left on the bicycle, Dan? Like any fibers or anything?
There was saliva, and you could see that in all the photos. Bishop, you're just gonna have to go back and watch and look at all
Okay, for sure.
the photos. But
That's
no, in
okay.
all seriousness, there was like saliva on one of the bike tires. There was some hair. And I want to say, I don't recall if the part of the leash was still on the bike. I don't think it was, but it was over in another section of the room, or the dining room just off the living room. So yeah, there was some evidence that the dog was tied up to that bike. It all matched. Dr. Wolf, you ready to break this necropsy down?
I'm ready to talk about it. I do have a question since you mentioned that there was blood at the scene.
Yeah.
Did you figure out whether or not it was from the dog or from the owner?
Yeah, so wonderful question. Now, in all my time there and training and experience there, we had no mechanism to have blood tested. And that was frustrating just because of the potential connections in a lot of the crimes that we dealt with. We just had no mechanism to collect it and or send it for testing.
For human or animal?
Yeah. Not well, let me rephrase this. Not on a dog case.
Okay.
That's how it was said to us. For an animal case, nah. Yeah, for sure. But great question.
Makes a lot of sense. Unfortunately, I think a lot of us are in that boat, and I know we are. We've had several cases where that would be the case, and it's just, well, it's just an
Frustrating.
animal case. It is. It's so frustrating. It's
Because
so
that
frustrating.
when you think about it, it's like it's not just an animal case. And so the interesting thing about this case is I use this as a case. I actually modified this case as a mock crime scene for a training I do for military law enforcement folks. And the only reason I do this training in general for these folks is to show them the connection between animal violence and human violence. And like we're starting to get that that's there, but a lot of our police departments just there it's just missing, right? In Colorado, there's a law, it's kind of known as Chloe's Law, but it's also the Dog Protection Act. And it's required that law enforcement officers take 3 hours of training to understand dog behavior and body language so they don't shoot and kill dogs, right? There is nothing in this country, these 50 states that we live in, that require police officers to take any training to understand the link between animal violence and human violence. It blows me away. We have six states that make it mandatory that police officer, and this is great. I don't want cops shooting dogs, but we have six states that recognize that as a need, but we don't have any states that recognize training for the link, as we call it, the link between domestic violence and animal abuse, making that mandatory. We don't have it.
Yeah, I was talking to one of our county ACOs, and he was saying the same thing. He is in charge of livestock unit, but they don't know anything about CEs in our industry. They don't know what to take or what's going to be beneficial. They don't really need it because they're TCOL certified. So why take it when you're already certified in that? It's just it's amazing. It's amazing.
Well, in the spirit of Henry Berg and the ASPCA and what he started 158 years ago, or however many now, is if I have any sort of impact on this profession, it's to bring awareness to the link between animal abuse and domestic violence, family violence, interpersonal violence. It's all connected. So, Doc, do you think in the necropsy report, should we talk about the gross necropsy findings? Where should we start?
I think we could start at a couple locations. I agree with you and Texas Bishop that this is a good report. I'm glad to see that cause of death, mechanism of death, and manner of death are all listed. That's not typical in my experience. Manner of death is a little bit of a controversy because we don't have anything that's considered the norm for animals. So usually we kind of riff off of what they do for people, but of course, with people, there's a possibility of manner of death being suicide. And we don't have that in our animals. I appreciate that they put the pathologic diagnoses right at the top there. That makes it easier to talk with non-veterinary folks about things.
Yeah, we'll get into that too, because I was gonna read some of this, but then I was like, well, I don't know how to read in other languages, so I might leave that for the doc to actually read it and then maybe have some breakdown, because that's part of the problem that we deal with is sometimes our veterinarians don't dumb it down for us, and then we need to ask a lot more questions.
Yeah, certainly that's one thing that I recommend for whether it's a necropsy report or report on a live animal exam, is for when veterinarians are writing up their report to write it in layperson's terms And then in a parenthetical, put in any kind of medical terminology they need to include so that if another veterinarian was reading it, the veterinarian would understand exactly what they were getting at. So maybe like you would put down something about having a fractured femur in the dog. So you'd say the dog has a broken hind leg. Parenthetical, here's all the terminology of, you know, was it a comminuted, was it an open fracture, or everything else that you might want to know about it. But you guys aren't going to care whether it's at a the epiphyseal fracture, or, you know, where it is exactly on the bone. You're not going to care so much, you know, whether it was a transverse fracture or spiral, you know, these kind of things. You just guys want to know that it was a fracture. So, as you say, kind of, you know, dumb it down, if you will, for lay people to understand.
Right, like even simple things like sternal or lateral recumbent. I'm like, sure, it might be basic, but a lot of people don't know what that means.
No.
Right. And that's another one where I would say, you know, write it down as the dog was lying on its right side, parenthetical, right lateral
Lateral.
recumbency.
Cool. Should we sh like? Should we just jump into this pathologic diagnosis? Do you want to start there? Or do you want
Sure,
to
I
start
can.
somewhere else?
No, I can read them off.
All right, cool. Thank you.
Anterior nose and lips, marked edema with microscopic hemorrhage and acute segmental myocyte necrosis.
So, yeah, what does that mean?
So edema is where there's fluid buildup, kind of outside of the vessels. It's fluid buildup in the tissues. So it gives it kind of a swollen appearance, like what you're seeing on the dog's nose. The microscopic hemorrhage is just saying that there is some bruising or contusion visible at the microscopic level, but not necessarily at the gross level, which means that they couldn't see it with their naked eye, but they could see it under the microscope. Acute segmental myocyte necrosis. Myocyte are muscle cells. Necrosis is a death. So they're saying that there are dead muscle cells, that acute means that it's a sudden onset versus some sort of a chronic condition that could cause this. And I believe, but I'm not a pathologist, so I may be incorrect on this, I believe that segmental is referring to how it looked under the microscope because of the wrapping of the muzzle, that it gave it a segmental appearance where part of it would have a very sharp margin between normal and abnormal. The second diagnosis was lung, left and right dorsal intercostal muscles, diaphragm, soft tissues of the back, right cranial lung lobe, pericardial sac, pancreas, caudal abdomen, and flank all had mild, acute, grossly visible hemorrhage. So what that means is that at the lung tissue, the muscles that are in between the ribs, the diaphragm, which is the flat muscle that's between the chest and the abdomen, the soft tissues of the back would be muscles and subcutaneous tissues like fat tissue, connective tissue. Right cranial lung lobe is just specifying that it is on the right side of the dog and it's the one that's closest to the head. Pericardial sac is the sac that surrounds the heart, the pancreas, caudal abdomen, and flank is referring to the kind of hindquarters of the dog. And then the caudal abdomen is the part of the abdomen that's closest to the hindquarters. So mild, acute, grossly visible hemorrhage means that there was a small amount of acute, so again, sudden, grossly visible, meaning that it could be seen with the naked eye, hemorrhage, meaning that it was bruising or contusion.
Got it.
The third diagnosis, second digit right hind foot, acute laceration with hemorrhage. So, this is just indicating that it's a right hind leg It's at the paw. It's the second digit, which we would think of as like our pointer finger. And acute laceration, so there is a sudden tearing of the tissue there with bleeding present. So the skin was torn. The fourth one is lung, liver, and kidney, marked vascular congestion with microscopic, mild, acute hepatic and renal hemorrhages. Vascular congestion, excuse me, vascular congestion just means that it's kind of like edema at the vessels, so they're swollen. Microscopic, mild, acute hepatic and renal hemorrhages refers to bleeding that is seen in the liver and the kidneys. And again, mild being that yes, it's there, but it's not a huge amount, and acute being a sudden bleed. And then the fifth one, heart, brain, periadrenal connective tissue, mild acute microscopic hemorrhages. So just more of the same at the heart, the brain, and the connective tissues around the adrenal glands.
So,
So
Dr.
is
Wolf,
all that, yes.
So like on a case like this, how important is it for the pathologist or the agency who's taking care of the necropsy to really do a thorough explanation on maybe the difference between, a fixation like we have in this case, or like heartworm disease? And I bring this up just because we've had a case like that where we know for sure that the dog was asphyxiated by hanging on a fence, but the end diagnosis was heartworm disease. The animal died of heartworm disease.
So some of that kind of gets into forensics versus veterinary pathologists. Just to kind of back up and do a little bit of an explanation there. A veterinary pathologist is someone who has been through veterinary school. They have the same veterinary degree as what I have, and then they go on to specialty training to become board certified pathologists. So they have additional, usually 3 to 5 years of training, and this is what teaches them to do necropsies and microscopic work. So they're the ones who will look at tissue samples under the microscope and make a diagnosis or try to assist with a diagnosis that way.
So fun,
There's
though.
debate in the two fields as to when you have a veterinary pathologist who has no training in forensics, and when you have a general practitioner who has training in forensics but is not a board certified pathologist, which one should be doing the necropsy at that point? And if you can get somebody who has both the board certification in pathology and training in forensics, hallelujah, that's your best bet. There's not a lot of pathologists out there who have that though. So it gets to be a little bit challenging. If in the case you were mentioning with the asphyxiation by having the collar caught on the fence and the dog has heartworm disease, depending on what is being seen on the necropsy, if it's appearing that the dog died from asphyxiation, which is one of those diagnoses you have to back yourself up into by ruling out everything else, but it's not something that you can look at on the necropsy and go, oh, I have this sign, therefore I know the dog died from asphyxiation. If you think that it's asphyxiation and the dog has heartworm disease, then the hard part can become, did the asphyxiation kill the dog or did the heartworm disease kill the dog? How advanced is the heartworm disease is be my biggest question. Is that if it's an early part of the disease, it's like, no, that dog is heartworm positive. It does have Dyrafilaria, the technical name for it. It doesn't mean the dog died from that, though. And that's what we have to be considering, is that did the dog actually die from that? And then cause of death can also be a little bit tricky to look at because it's not necessarily what happened in the immediate. It could be something that was set off a long time ago. So like a dog that may have been shot a year ago, that projectile was left inside, somehow it got dislodged into a vessel, traveled through the body and caused a fatal embolism in the lungs. Well, the embolism is what actually killed the dog in that moment, but it was all started from being shot. So cause of death was gunshot wound leading to a pulmonary embolism. So this is where it can get complicated to look at all of that and try and figure out which came first, which one killed the animal. Was that
Makes
too much
sense.
explanation or does that make sense?
No, that makes
No,
absolute
that's, yeah, that
sense.
was pretty cool actually, because that's not something I would have ever thought about, Bishop. So thank you for bringing that up. And it's so fun to just be able to call you Bishop because it's just in my natural flow of stuff. For those, if you're listening for your first time, our normal co-host is Ashley Bishop. Our fill-in co-host is Ashley Bishop. You can't make this up. Back to the necropsy. Do we want to do you, should we read? Where do you want to go next? This is your world, Doc. So I'm going to let you kind of just pick where we go next and kind of how we finalize everything here.
Well, two questions that I wanted to ask when I was looking over the report. One is that it looks like as though the dog was sent in with all the ropes and the makeshift muzzle and so forth in place. Is that
Yes,
accurate?
it is.
Okay, good. I want to commend those who did it that way because that is one problem that I'll see is that those who see the body first remove things, throw them away, otherwise take them off and dispose of them or don't tell me about them in the first place. And that's a problem when you're doing the necropsy. If there's an IV catheter in place, if there's a muzzle on, if there's a collar, whatever it is, leave it and let the pathologist or whomever is doing your necropsy have that material, remove it. They can collect it for evidence if they have it with them. It just helps to figure out what's going on when you've got all that with you. Did they take any photos?
They did. There's some pretty, as I would say, gnarly photos. Just because, again, I'm not trained in this world, and so seeing some of like the, let's see, I'll just put one in the chat that I think is. So they labeled everything. They start their photos with the muzzle on, and then here's a photo right here with the muzzle off. So after they removed the muzzle, they took a photo with the identifying markers. They had numbers associated with the date and their number, their unique ID number. And then there's internal things like this looks like, I don't know if that's the liver or spleen or what. I'm sending you a very dark, maybe bruising inside the body. I don't know because again, this is not my world. And they even go as far as taking the brain out, which I'm going to send to you right now.
Is that a liver, Dr. Wolf?
It looks like as though you guys are in the thoracic cavity. We have the heart and lungs. Diaphragm is off to the right.
Oh, liver's right there.
And y'all wonder why I'm vegan. I'm just saying. Looking at that stuff, I'm like, ah, I'll pass.
I honestly don't know if I've ever gotten pictures this detailed before in a necropsy.
They're really cool, and again, they'll be here on the YouTube version, so.
Yeah, I commend the
Yeah.
pathologist who did this because, yeah, I don't usually see a lot of photos, if any, when I'm looking at ones necropsies that have been done by others. But it's great that they had the muzzle still in place. They took it off, took before and after photos. That's fabulous. Really great to see.
Kudos to CSU.
Yes. Yes. So, reading through the description underneath the pathologic diagnoses, these are the remarks, conclusions, opinions, however you'd like to rephrase it, from the pathologist. And again, I thought it was a really good job. Do you want me to just read it to you?
Yeah, go ahead. I think that for their listeners, that'll be great. And then we can kind of summarize it. And yeah, I think from
Okay.
your perspective, it would be really cool to hear.
Agreed.
Okay. The muzzle was very tightly tied, producing marked edema of the skin of the nose and lips, and acute muscle injury in the lip. This muzzle tightly opposed the jaws, such that little, if any, air movement was possible through the oral cavity. Additionally, edema of the soft tissues of the nose restricted air movement through the nostrils. Grossly visible and microscopic lesions consist of acute hemorrhage and marked visceral congestion. Hemorrhages in the intercostal muscles and diaphragm are attributed to marked acute muscular exertion secondary to exaggerated respiratory effort. Marked congestion in the lungs is indicative of pulmonary hypertension in response to hypoxia. Generalized hemorrhages in multiple organs are considered agonal in nature, while the acute laceration of a toe on the right hind foot and bruising of soft tissues at the back and caudal abdomen slash flank area are indicative of trauma. Whether or not this trauma was self-inflicted from struggling or from external force cannot be determined. The sole hemorrhagic lesion considered nonspecific and incidental is pancreatic interstitial hemorrhage, as this is commonly encountered in dogs who have died from a variety of causes, including elective euthanasia. In summary, this animal suffered non-accidental death secondary to a very tightly tied muzzle, which restricted airflow. Inability to breathe a sufficient volume of air resulted in hypoxia and acute cardiopulmonary collapse. The muscle had been present for a sufficient period of time prior to death to result in edema and microscopically visible muscle injury with an inflammatory response. No pre-existent or intercurrent disease condition or abnormality was found. So that was written very well for other veterinarians.
And what really jumped out off the page, and I'd love your opinion on it, is the dog died from a non-accidental death, is how they wrote it. Is that was something you were kind of talking about earlier, how it's kind of hard to put that maybe just because of, like, you mentioned, like, in
All
humans, we can,
circumstances, yeah.
I was trying to
Right,
find the right
that
words, but yeah.
what the pathologist has done here is to confirm the, well, I guess I should say to rule out the possibility of this having been from some other disease process. That's the
Sure.
part of no pre-existent or intercurrent disease condition or abnormality was found. The pathologist also took all of the circumstantial evidence of having this leash or whatever it was tied around the muzzle, the swelling on the face, and so forth, to say, hey, this is absolutely consistent with the muzzle that's in place, and it's consistent with a death from asphyxiation.
So sad.
So, yes, I thought it was a really good report, but I could also see how this portion of it would not necessarily be understandable by most people who are not in the veterinary field.
Certainly.
So, personally, I would have tried rewriting that in a way that would be better for laypersons, and then again, put a lot of medical terminology into the parentheses so that other veterinarians could read it in this manner, if you will, but lay people would be able to understand it better.
Do you think this would be appropriate for the court? This piece of shit tied this dog's muzzle shut and hung it on a bicycle and it choked to death. You think that probably wouldn't be good for court?
No, that would not be good for court. That would be inflammatory, to say the
Just how I'm
least.
feeling, okay, Doc?
Nobody needs to be in our heads when we go to court, Dan. You and I both very
I
much know that. I'm sure
know.
Dr. Wolf does as well.
I know. I'm just
Yes.
saying, just how I feel. Thank you so
Yeah.
much for joining us today and just giving that insight from a perspective that is different than ours in the field. That is super, I think, very, I mean, I don't want to speak for anybody, but I think it was super informative and super just neat to hear from more of the scientific background than my inflammatory terms. So.
Welcome. Thank
I
you for
agree.
having me. I agree with your wanting to phrase it that way, but yes, I would have just simply said that the dog died from a lack of air secondary to the tied muzzle.
Yeah. And that's the right approach, 100%. Is there so vin.com, right? So is your contact information there if people want to get a hold of you? What's the best way if someone's like, "Oh, I want to run something by you," or how does that work?
My contact information is not on VIN. The website for VIN is vin.com. The website for my business is wvfcinc.com. It stands for Wolf Veterinary Forensics Consulting Incorporated .com.
And before you go, what is your favorite animal?
Cats.
Oh, you know, it's so cool. And I love this with Zoom because you can blur your background. And then your cat would be there, like,
Popped up.
and then it just pops.
Yeah.
It's just like, but I don't think that's, I honestly don't think that's just because of Zoom. I think cats can just do that. There's like, I disappear and I reappear. They're amazing. I love cats. Cool. Well, thanks again. You're always welcome back on the show. If you ever have anything, any information you want to give out to our listeners, you know, come on or give us the updates, and we'll absolutely share it. So, thank you so much for taking the time out today, and please go back and check out the full episode with all. I'm going to edit in some of the photos, and you'll get to see the defendant here. Does anyone want to know what happened to him? Should we have that as closure, or should we just leave that as a cliffhanger?
I'm curious, you
Yeah.
know?
Yeah, I'd
Yeah.
want to know.
So, remember we were talking about animals and how, oh, it's just an animal case. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's just an animal case. And so in this scenario, this man was charged with a felony animal cruelty. they, let's see, did they, da, da, da. They, let's see, did they plea it down to a misdemeanor, which would be, so it was a felony and a class six felony. 18-9-202 is the statute in Colorado. He took a plea of guilty. He got a deferred sentence. He had 2 days time served in jail. The case was then, or the charge was then dismissed, because in Colorado, if you take a deferred sentence and then you complete all of your required probation, then that charge goes away, which is just absolutely asinine to me. So he basically ended up, so what they did, as I look through the form here, and this will be there in the on the YouTube as well. He the main charge, they pled it down, so it was initially charged as a felony. They pled it down to a misdemeanor, animal cruelty. So the difference between felony and misdemeanor in Colorado is aggravated animal cruelty. So I guess they were able to determine that that wasn't aggravated, which I don't know why. The comments by the judge was the defendant was undergo mental health evaluation and treatment, is not allowed to own animals at that time until it is determined by probation. And that was pretty much it.
So was his record wiped clean at the end of all that as
It
well?
is. That's how that works with a deferred
The
judgment there.
deferred.
Yep. So isn't that crazy? He can go,
So
he has no animal cruelty. Like, he can literally go work at an animal
an animal
shelter
shelter.
or be an animal control officer or be a veterinarian, though he brutally murdered his own dog.
Well, I'm thinking also that it wipes away any kind of a record should he show signs of violence towards people,
Such a good
showing that the
perspective.
link is there
It
and
is.
that it's moving forward. I mean, I don't know, they don't all graduate using the graduate hypothesis, but
Sure.
it'd be something that should be useful later in court if it
100%.
were needed. So, yeah,
And I
that's
love that
disappointing.
perspective. And so what sucks is, like, So the FBI, and I know people probably are like, this is a long episode, but we need to talk about this really quick. The FBI was collecting animal cruelty data, but the problem with that is you have to be a law enforcement agency in order to get that information into the NIBRS database. And the majority of our animal control agencies throughout the country fall either under humane societies or public health or just municipal government and not law enforcement. And so they're only capturing 25%, maybe 30, 40%, if they're even giving that data. And so if I wasn't so stretched thin, one project that I would love to work on is collecting all this data and having a central database for oh, you tell them, boy, for animal cruelty, because we need to track it.
Agreed. Do you follow up with these kind of cases, Dan? Like, it's done in the courts and all that stuff. Do you follow up with these people just to check in, or is it just kind of a one and done and here we go?
Well, I did Google him so we could see where he works, but that's a different episode. So I don't want to do anything I shouldn't say. But I'll just say that the reality being is no, and I should do more of that. But and I also don't work in that town anymore, so it's hard for me to follow up. But if there was something like we just got a case where somebody was told they couldn't own animals, like we might follow up in that scenario.
And there were no concerns for the aunt or for the grandmother.
No, surprisingly, right? And when we told them why we were there, and I'm glad you brought that up, like they were a little like seemed surprised, like they didn't, I guess he didn't tell them that he choked the dog to death basically, and by wrapping a muzzle and then tethering it to a bicycle. So when they found out that there was criminal action, they were concerned, but not like hysterical or anything of that nature. So
And they weren't being hard on themselves in any way then.
not that we could see. No, he didn't appear that. Now, who knows what that relationship was like behind closed doors, but at that moment, no. Nope.
All good things to think about, Dr. Wolf. Thank you. You're just all I, we got a lot of cases going on right now, and I'm just thinking of all of that and
I know
bringing new perspective on my end.
we could probably do hundreds of episodes just like this.
For sure.
Oh, and it's sad. It's sad
It
'cause
is. It is. It is. It's unfortunate.
Well, thanks again for joining us. Thanks for listening. Please check us out wherever you go on social media. Stuff's at Facebook, Instagram. I'll try to do better at Snapchat, and TikTok. But I'm only one person. It's hard. It's hard. Cool. Well, as we like to say on the episodes, thanks for listening. Let's continue to help people help animals and keep it humane.